It's time for the I Love Ann Show.
Oh, that's right. And today it is my very big pleasure to bring you Congressman James Clyburn. He is up there in Washington, D.C. How you doing, Congressman?
I'm just fine. Thank you so much for having me this morning. You doing well, I hope.
I certainly am. And how is it in Washington, D.C.? Is it going to be a hot one?
It's going to be a hot one. It's been that way for a couple of weeks now.
Absolutely.
I understand it won't break until maybe next week.
Y'all will still be there, what, till August 6th? Is that right?
Well, we're here until about the, I think, August 2nd. Second or third. Right.
Okay. And Congressman, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, when you were on back in April, there was a question of whether South Carolina would be able to, score the funds to be able to deepen the port. I presume you had a big part in making sure that South Carolina got that port deepening stuff done.
Well, some months ago, maybe five, six months ago, earlier this year, I sat down over lunch with President Obama and Vice President Biden, and we talked about various things that were of national interest going forward. Of course, one of the things I brought up was the deepening of the Charleston Harbor. I made it very clear to the President and the Vice President that harbor did have national significance on two fronts. First of all, a lot of us are aware that a lot of the spent nuclear fuel that's coming out of places in Europe and are coming back to the country come back through that harbor. That port is very significant from that perspective. Secondly, I have been led to believe that the coming from the Panama Canal up the East Coast is a shorter route via the water into Charleston than it is into Savannah, though it may look differently when you look at the map in terms of the way the river and the ocean are configured. It's a shorter route coming into Charleston. So in that argument, at the close of that discussion, the president turned to Vice President Biden and said to him, well, Joe, let's see, can we get this done? Following that meeting, there was a meeting of the entire delegation with Jim Newsom down at the Port Sacramento Ports Authority. And I said to them at that meeting, as I'm saying this morning, there's an S on port. People tend to think of this as only being Charleston, but there's a port in Georgetown that I think is very important. So I put both these things on their radar. So far, because of the national interest and importance, Charleston. But I'm now working to try to get the same kind of a treatment or similar treatment for Georgetown as well.
Well, that certainly is good news for South Carolina. Now, I understand that we have, of course, this sequestration that could be coming up at if something isn't done. And I happen to see where Barney Frank and Mick Mulvaney were working together on trying to get some defense cuts that would be, shall we say, sensible cuts. What do you think about what's happening with this across the aisle working together?
Well, I don't believe we're going to get to any kind of sequestration at all. If you recall, I was on the so-called super committee.
Exactly.
I was on the Biden task force. Seven of us met several times, about 10 times to be exact, with the Biden group, and then 12 of us on the so-called super committee. We know what has to be done. to avoid sequestration. By the way, the Frank Mulvaney amendment did pass overwhelmingly in the House, and I'm assuming it'll meet with a similar response by the Senate. So if the truth be told, it makes for a lot of political back and forth, but there is plenty enough time after the election and before December 31st for us to do a one-year extension that will allow the time that's necessary to work out a more comprehensive approach to the stuff going forward. There's not going to be a sequestration, and I pretty much predict that.
Well, you said it right here on WCRS, so we'll see how that goes. But Congressman Clyburn, you know, one of my issues is, don't you think we should be taking care of this before the election rather than after the election in a lame duck session?
Well, if you had to do the whole thing, I think all of us are aware that when you get this close to the election and you got two competing visions for what it ought to be, I happen to subscribe to that vision enunciated by President Obama, that is that we ought to extend the tax cuts on income below 250 and below. All of those tax cuts ought to be extended. Now, I just said income.
I heard you.
For 250 and below. Every time I pick up a newspaper or listen to the radio or watch TV, people says on people who earn 250 or below. That's not what it is. It's on income. So if you make $1 million, your first $250,000 will continue to get the tax cut. It is on the income above 250 that President Obama would like to terminate the tax cuts so that the people who are making that kind of income will begin to contribute a little bit more. And let's be honest here, maybe I ought not be so honest. If we are in the kind of situation that we're in, this country is, who are we asking to make sacrifices? Who are we asking? People who are very, very wealthy got all these tax cuts, so they aren't making any sacrifices. People who are working every day and making $50,000 and $60,000 a year, they are paying 25 and 26% taxes. They'll be, and people who are making millions are paying 14% of their income in taxes. Who is making a sacrifice here? Who are the volunteers who are off fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq? The very, very wealthy people are not doing that fighting. It is those people who are looking, cannot afford college, and a lot of them going to the military, looking to get the kind of training they will get for the future. A lot of them, they do want to serve the country. They want to be good soldiers. But those are mostly people who aren't making, families aren't making $1 million a year. Those families are making sacrifices. So let's be fair here and say, well, people who are making millions don't want to pay any taxes. They aren't serving in the military. They aren't doing community kind of service. So who is making a sacrifice?
Well, don't you think at some point that they did do these things? Many of these people did serve in the military. Many of these people are great contributors to their communities, whether it's in grants or endowments or all this type of thing. So, you know, I think it's fine to say that, but don't...
Well, it's a fact. The fact of the matter, well, let's just use one good example, you know, not to be positive. How much service did Romney make? How many? He's got five sons. How many of them went into the military? Come on. It's just not a fair deal. And he won't release his taxes, and so nobody knows how much taxes he paid. In fact, there's a school of thought here in Washington that the reason he will not release the taxes because there were 2 years in there when he paid absolutely no taxes at all.
But that's
so what's your sacrifice?
But, well, you know, I don't think you and I don't want to get on to talking this type of thing. I want to talk about the things that are really interesting to our listeners here.
Well, I don't know who your listeners are, but everywhere I go, I was up in Charlotte Friday night at the Quadrennial. Every 4 years, the AME Zions meet up in Charlotte. Every person I talk to very interested in whether or not sacrifices are going to be shared by the wealthy as well as the not-so-wealthy. Every person I talk to is concerned
about that.
Well,
absolutely, but I meant talking about tax returns and this type of thing. I wanted to keep it more on talking about what can be done. If do you think, so you do not believe that this would have any effect on, just to use the Republicans' comments, that job creation would be cut back, and would the money that would be coming in if this happened, would that make a significant difference in the budget as far as money's coming in, or would we be better off to have more people working and paying taxes? Which would it be, James?
Well, let's just say this: I believe that the best predictor of the future is, in fact, the past. In 1993, we heard these identical arguments when President Clinton put forth his budget in 1993. I was sitting here. I was listening to it. Everything I'm hearing today was the exact same thing. The economy is going to tank if we pass this budget. Job creation will come to a screeching halt. It'll put us into a recession. I wish you would go back and just read some of the debate that took place on the floor, the arguments against President Clinton's budget. We passed that budget by one vote. Because of passing that budget, the Democrats lost control. That's when Newt Gingrich took over
right.
In the next election in 1994. All because the people believe all of that foolishness what damage we did to the country. Well, over the next 8 years, 22 million new jobs was created. Now, that's a fact. That is what happened, rather than all of those dire predictions of what these tax increases that President Clinton push forward would do. All we're saying now, let's return our tax rates to the Clinton era tax rates. That's what President Obama is saying. We have seen what those rates will do across the board. Let's go back to them because we saw what happened when we walked away from those tax rates and George W. Bush put through the tax cuts he did. And the economy tanked. All I'm saying is the best predictor of the future is, in fact, the past.
You know, I don't have any problem with what you're saying there. I guess what I have read is that the dollars that are generated from that, don't we really need tax reform, you know, across the board, not just these simple things? And I guess my question would be, why haven't we worked on getting some of these things done, rather than constantly putting it off, whether it's...
Well, nobody's putting it off. The president has been proposing us ever since he's been here. And you've got Mitch McConnell in the Senate using the filibuster and making it very clear in his public statements that his number one priority is to try to make Obama a one-term president, not to create jobs, not to reform the tax code, but to make President Obama a one-term president. Now, you and I know how effective a filibuster can be. It postponed my coming to Congress by centuries because the filibuster was used time and time again in the Senate to beat back civil rights, beat back voting rights, and they're doing the same thing to beat back President Obama's program. one person under the Senate rules can gum up the works in the Senate and keep anything from going forward. Now, those are facts.
Well, so how about Harry Reid and no budget being put forth in the Senate?
If you got to have 60 votes to even bring it to a vote, the Democrats don't have 60 votes. So this whole thing about Harry Reid being in charge, he is not in charge. The filibuster is in charge, and we know that. And why we keep denying that is beyond me, especially those of us from South Carolina. The champion filibuster in the history of the United States Congress was J. Strom Thurmond. He holds the record for filibustering the 1957 Civil Rights Act as a young man at the age of 17. I withered many times as he kept civil rights bills from going forward. And this was after the 1954 Supreme Court decision. So we in South Carolina are very familiar as to how effective the filibuster can be when people don't want to see progress going forward.
I understand.
So, okay.
I understand what you're saying.
Uh-huh. That's what's happening up here right now.
Why can't if you can have Barney Frank and Mick Mulvaney work on an amendment, why can't we see more of this?
Well, we do see a lot of that. Remember, that's the House.
Right.
And it's already gone. That bill passed the House last week.
Right. But why can't we see more of this type of action?
So in order for it to be brought up for consideration in the Senate, you're going to need 60 votes. Where would the 60 votes come from? That means some Republicans must vote for it, just 10.
Well, Mick Mulvaney is a Republican, and
he is in the House once again.
In the House. I understand that.
Okay.
And you're telling me there's no possibility?
There's not going to be 10 Republicans to vote for it in this. That's what I'm telling you.
Okay.
It takes 10 Republicans. If all the Democrats voted for it, it still takes 10 Republicans. If all the Republicans voted for it, it would take 10, give or take a few, 10 Democrats. The country is evenly split that way.
Well, what about, let's move on. What about this new Simpson-Bowles Plus? Have you heard about that?
Oh, there's nothing new about Simpson
no,
Bowles.
No, the plus. They've added a plus to it. I'm not really
sure. I don't know about the plus. I do know that a Simpson Bowles plus bill came before the Senate, and I've got, I had it sitting here in the corner of my office, this little thing thanking me for being one of 30 Democrats to vote for it. It's a real nice little plaque that somebody gave me. I don't remember what I did with it. I thought I had it sitting here in my office to look at. But the fact of the matter is, I think I've demonstrated by my vote that something akin to Simpson-Bowles is something that I can support.
Something you can support.
I've already done it.
I know you have. But, I mean, do you think there's any possibility of it being brought back around?
Oh, it passed the House once again. The Senate is a different animal, and if it looks like some kind of accomplishment for the president, Mitch McConnell would never let it pass.
Well, okay. Now, how do you see? There is a lot of, right now, President Obama and Mitt Romney are very evenly matched right now out there in the polls. Most of them, they're ahead. One's ahead and then the other, but they're very close. How do you see the divisions and everything in our country coming out comes November?
Well, I have no idea. I think that both parties will have their conventions the last
end of August,
2 weeks
of September.
In August. After those conventions, both candidates will have about three significant debates, and I really believe that somewhere around the second week or third week of October, things will begin to firm up. As it stands right now, I think we're going to go forward with about 46 to 47, Romney 1 week, Obama the next week, with about 8 to 10% of the people still saying we're undecided. That 8 to 10% will move somewhere around the third week of October. until then, anybody saying that they know what's going to happen is not telling the truth. The fact of the matter is, these things could rather turn on one gaffe in a debate or one enunciation. I will always believe that Jimmy Carter was able to defeat Ford because Ford made a big gaffe on Poland in the debate, and it started a narrative that played into some other things that had happened. I'll always believe that Nixon and Kennedy, the debate, turned on Kimoi and Matsu, and as well as how they look on television. But these things happen. So I really believe this election in November would turn on either a speech from the conventions or a statement or two during the debates.
You think the media is controlling things too much?
The media?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't know whether it's too much, but I think that what we I think the media is fine. Your show is a great show, in my opinion.
Thank you.
I'm not up there listening to all the other shows that you have, but the ones you have with me are pretty good. but when people, I think that we are now defining media as people like Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is no media. And those are the people that's controlling stuff. This Breedbop guy, the late Breedbop fella, my wife frets about him often. In fact, something just happened with an attorney with the same name was in the newspapers as I was leaving home on yesterday morning. My wife asked me, you reckon this is the same family? Because she remembers what he did to that poor grandmother, taking her words, reframing her words, calling himself a media person, and just ruined her career. And we've seen plenty of people ruin, and we call it media.
Yeah,
that's not media.
No, that's not the news. That's true. Well, one more question. I know you're real proud, and I did want everybody to know about this. The rural monies that are available through the Ag Department. You want to just tell us about that real quick?
Oh, thank you so much for mentioning the Rural Energy Savings Programs. A lot of people call it Rural Star. It's a program, I wish I could say it, that it originated with me. It did not. It originated with the South Carolina co-ops. They were doing this to try to help some of their customers who were having real problems paying utility bills while out of work. And they came up with this plan by which they would loan money out to their customers to retrofit their homes, average about $6,500. The savings they would have on their utility bills could then be used to pay the loan back in their monthly payments. It worked so well in South Carolina. When I found out about it, I brought it up here, introduced it as a national program. It passed the House twice, still hung up, being filibustered in the Senate. It never could pass the Senate. But I went to President Obama and told him that I thought this is something that he ought to put in his budget. He didn't put it in his budget, but he then asked Secretary Vilsack to take a look to see whether or not it's something we could implement. So Secretary Vilsack has now put in $250 million to take this program nationwide. I want to put in $1 billion to make it 100% coverage for rural homes so that people and businesses in rural communities can retrofit their businesses, retrofit their homes, start the savings on their utility bills, use those savings to pay back the loan, and do that within 9 years. And in 9 years, everybody will have a real good home and business, and will have saved millions of dollars.
Absolutely. Well, Congressman Clyburn, it is always a pleasure to have you on my show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. You have a great day. God
bless.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.